welcoming you all virtually to the LSE. It would be much nicer were I able to welcome you to a real lecture theatre in one of our buildings here in London. But there are practical advantages in us all being able to Zoom in from wherever we are. And there are huge advantages that technology allows this event, which was originally going to be a succession of in-person events, to nevertheless happen as a virtual event. My name is Piers Ludlow. I'm the head of the International History Department, one of the organizations sponsoring and co-hosting tonight's event. But it's also one which is really important in the life of the department in that it marks the beginning of an important new initiative, largely organized and masterminded by Victoria Phillips, launching a project looking at the history, culture, and diplomacy. It's a project focused particularly on the Cold War period, but not just on the Cold War period, and looking at the kind of interplay of soft power and hard power, but also real war and some of the things that can go around it. So it's a potentially very exciting new strand of intellectual activity at the school, and it's one where we're looking forward over the months and years ahead to welcome a number of speakers, visiting scholars, and others to be associated with the project. So it's something we're delighted to launch. I'm very pleased to be associated with this, although I can claim absolutely no credit because this was largely Victoria's idea, concocted to a certain extent with my predecessor, Professor Matthew Jones, who I'm pleased to see is one of the audience today. But it's on my watch that the first event occurs, so it's me who's doing the introductions. What I'm going to do, I'm basically going to try and say as little as possible, which is always a good idea, but my job is primarily to introduce the speakers. So I will do so now, and then I will hand over to Victoria to sort of mastermind events from there on. Can I briefly say before I do so, though, most of you seem to know the form, but can I ask everybody to mute their microphones when they're not speaking? And can I also remind you that the event, the sort of interventions from the floor are being recorded, but the plan will not be to record the Q&A. So what the speakers say first up will be preserved for posterity, but what follows will not. Okay, so let me go through the speakers, I think in the order that they're speaking, but I may have got this wrong. So first up, I believe, is Margaret Peacock, who is an associate professor and director of undergraduate studies in the Department of History at the University of Alabama. And she is somebody who, although trained as a Russian historian, sees herself more as a global historian of propaganda and media. What she's going to be talking about today, I understand, is primarily something based on something she is currently writing or has just finished writing with Eric Peterson on the Journal of a Pandemic Year, which is a look at what the COVID crisis that we're all living through means for academics in general and historians in particular. So that's what she's going to, that's her sort of direction of travel today. Second speaker, as I understand it, is Audra Wolfe, who is the author of a number of books, including most recently Freedom's Laboratory, The Cold War Struggle for the Soul of Science. And she is also somebody who publishes widely in The Atlantic, Washington Post, etc. So she will be speaking second. Then I believe we have Patrick Babiraki, who's an associate professor of history at the University of Texas at Arlington and the author of Soviet Soft Power in Poland, Culture and the Making of Stalin's New Empire, 1943 to 1957. That was a book that clearly ought to have been on the reading list for the class I taught this morning and wasn't, for which I beg forgiveness and will amend it for next year. And then fourth of our speakers is going to be Blanche Wiesen-Cook, who is a distinguished professor of history and women's studies at John Jay College of Criminal Justice and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. And she is somebody who has written notably a three-volume biography of Eleanor Roosevelt. And last and very definitely not least, given that this is her project and she's going to be in charge of proceedings from now on, let me also introduce Dr. Victoria Phillips, who is currently a visiting fellow and guest teacher in this department, but more importantly is the person who came up with the idea for the History, Culture and Diplomacy project, and is somebody who is also working on a biography of another formidable Eleanor, this time Eleanor Dulles, and will be taking charge of proceedings from now on. So I think I'm going to hand over to Victoria and then proceed sort of straight into the speeches. Okay, so that's enough for me.
Piers, thank you so much. And all I can say is that this project has been inspired by the four speakers on this screen and their glorious books and scholarship. And certainly could not be done without the support of Matthew and you, Piers, and the London School of Economics for hosting this and being so warm and welcoming to new ideas and new scholarship. So I thank you all. And thank you for your introductions. We're actually going to start with Audra. We flipped the order. So without further ado, Audra, I hand it over to you.
Well, thank you so much for that introduction. And thank you everybody who has chosen to join us today. We have been invited to talk about our future work, and I will get there eventually, but I'm going to start by talking a little bit more about this book that I published in 2018 that's now available in paper, Freedom's Laboratory, The Cold War Struggle for the Soul of Science. This book, in a nutshell, was trying to get at the question of why so many American scientists insist on saying that science has no politics when it's patently obvious that that's not true. And there are a lot of different answers to that question, but in this book, I explore the role of Cold War propaganda in that story. So this was really a book that was attempting to uncover the role of ideas about science, particularly scientific freedom, in Cold War cultural diplomacy. So sort of in the same vein of works that we know on cultural diplomacy in, you know, arts or dance or sport, kind of doing some of the same work with science. So it's looking at both covert and overt, public and private programs, all of which really amplified and circulated this idea that there was a special relationship between science and freedom and democracy. It was particularly drawing out ideas that there was a kind of science in the West that was the opposite of science in the Soviet Union. So if science in the Soviet Union was dogmatic, science in the West was empirical. If science in the Soviet Union was controlled by the government, science in the Soviet Union was controlled by the government, science in the West was kind of objective. If science in the Soviet Union was driven by technological goals, science in the West was focused on basic research. And finally, if science in the Soviet Union was intensely nationalistic, that science in the West was dedicated to international cooperation. I want to make clear that this is a caricature of Soviet science, but this was really a foil against which the United States was really in many ways developing and circulating some ideas about how science worked. And the book really, it has a vaguely chronological approach. It certainly has a narrative with a beginning and middle and end. It talks about where these ideas about Western science and Marxist science came from, how they really solidified in the years after World War II, particularly with Lysenko's ascent to power in the Soviet Union, how they changed really over the course of the Cold War, particularly with Sputnik being a turning point when the United States really embraced ideas about science and scientific prestige as a leading tool in promoting ideas about the American way of life. It also looks at how these ideas played into the developing structures for scientific intelligence gathering, because of course it's much easier to gather intelligence, particularly open intelligence, if you're promoting ideas that science knows no borders and that scientists should share information freely. The last part of the book looks at how some of these ideas about science not having politics really fell apart in the United States with the Vietnam War, and then how they kind of came back in slightly different ways in more recent years. So the book was really looking at, really focused on kind of two questions, one present-oriented and one more for historians. I'll start with the second one for historians for this crowd, which is just to say that I was really trying to understand why science had been so absent from the stories that we tell about cultural diplomacy. And I think it's, you know, for historians of science, sometimes it's just some very specific bits of information that we're missing. For instance, how some of the covers worked. If you know that the Asia Foundation was mainly a proprietary of the CIA from its creation until 1967, projects funded by the Asia Foundation look differently than if you don't know that. And so sometimes there were just pieces of information that scholars, the diplomatic historians know that historians of science didn't, to change how these stories have been told. And for diplomatic historians, I think so much of the work on science in diplomatic history has really been focused on science as stuff. If we're thinking of kind of objects, if we're thinking about weapons, or maybe even intelligence. But part of what I'm arguing is that these ideas about what science is and how it operates were absolutely part of cultural arguments. In part, this has to do with the ways that modernization theory was part of foreign policy during this time period. But so I'm really trying to bring that front and center. But of course, this was also a very present-oriented book. I wanted to understand what was at stake with scientists' claims to be able to operate free of politics. And because I really started writing this book, I was researching it beginning in 2010, but the really the guts of writing it began in 2015. There were a lot of ways in which I saw the book at that time as a kind of prehistory of science diplomacy. Now, for those of you who aren't that familiar with this term, science diplomacy has been around for a while, but that particular term for it is new-ish. And the Obama administration was doing science diplomacy in a big way, particularly as an alternative to, as a way to build relationships with Muslim-majority countries after the global war on terror, as kind of a reset. They were using these ideas that, really ideas about science and scientists to build relationships. But this wasn't simply an American phenomenon. There was a great enthusiasm for science diplomacy in the EU, in the UK, in Asia during this time period. And so just to kind of recap what people meant by science diplomacy at the time that I was writing this book, this is a kind of a landmark report that was jointly issued by the Royal Society and the AAAS called New Frontiers in Science Diplomacy. They really laid out a three-pronged definition of science diplomacy that has become very popular. The first is science in diplomacy. And this is simply the idea that in terms of normal diplomatic relationships, sometimes you need access to certain kinds of factual expertise about science and technology. You know, this is things like you need to know certain things about how nuclear weapons are developed, for instance, if you're negotiating non-proliferation treaties. So that is a form of science in diplomacy. The second idea is diplomacy for science. And so this is about diplomatic relationships that allow scientific research and partnerships to take place. So for instance, the various agreements that allow, that govern and allow research in Antarctica. That's an example of diplomacy for science, or various kinds of partnerships for space research. That's diplomacy for science. The third kind is the one that I was most interested in, and that is science for diplomacy. And this is this idea that really came out of the Cold War, that you could use ideas about science and scientists, the nature of science, the nature of scientific communication, to build different kinds of relationships. And this is the part that I was so fascinated by. You know, I went to a lecture in maybe 2010, 2011 by John Holdren, Obama's science advisor, and it could have been given in 1962. You know, all the language that he was using about how scientists have this ability to transcend politics by talking the language of science. I was fascinated by this for a lot of reasons, but in part because it's definitionally ridiculous, right? If you're thinking about diplomacy, you know, this is not something that is separate from politics. This definition is nonsensical. And so it's a concept, it's a way of doing diplomacy that depends on an idea that science is somehow both apart from and essential to politics. And I was really just absolutely fascinated by that. So I just want to walk you through a couple ways that this worked out during the Cold War, and then I'm going to talk about how it's different now and how that's shaping what I'm going to do next, or what I'm still trying to figure out what I'm going to do next, and I'll get to that. So this first part is this idea of really science as statecraft, that the way that you can do science and be science says something about your country and the way that it relates to others. Particularly after Sputnik, when the United States realized that it probably couldn't win the space race, and of course that turned out to be wrong, but from 1957, the United States assumed that it was going to lag in the space race for a long time. And so there was an explicit strategy that what the United States could advance was an attitude of cooperation, that it could be the best cooperator, that it could establish ways for different countries to work together and participate with one another to make different kinds of scientific achievement. And it's both a incredibly cynical and brilliant idea in that it in some ways would allow the United States to take partial credit for scientific advances made anywhere in the world if it helped set up the infrastructure for those to take place. All of this is also, you know, deeply cynical, obviously, in a whole lot of ways, but this person I have on that I'm showing you, this is Wallace Brody, who was the science advisor at the State Department after Sputnik. His previous job, he was a chemist, but before that, he had been the CIA's first head of scientific intelligence in the late 1940s. And so Brody, in particular, was somebody who had thought a lot about the ways that establishing paths for scientific cooperation would allow the United States to both sincerely advance the values that many scientists shared, and also advance American foreign policy interests in very, very specific and practical ways. So another way that this comes out is, or an interesting question to think with, is this question of scientific exceptionalism, which is really the question of, should science be exempt from the rest of the rules that govern US foreign policy? So let me make this specific to clarify what I mean by this. So in the 1950s, the United States had an official policy of non-recognition for several communist countries, including North Korea, People's Republic of China, East Germany. And in the late 1950s, some of these, particularly the People's Republic of China and North Korea, started making more bids to participate in international scientific organizations. And the United States policies of non-recognition said that official representatives from the United States government could not participate in meetings in which there were official people from these other countries. And so this put the United States in a bind for its science programming. The United States had several choices. It could simply stop sending official representatives to these kinds of meetings, which of course presented a problem because the United States was in part relying on these kinds of interactions to gather certain kinds of scientific intelligence. The second alternative would be to make a fuss and to somehow throw around its power in ways that would, say, exclude North Korea from participating in scientific meetings. But that, of course, would be politicizing science, which the United States claimed that it did not do. The third option would be to say, well, these rules don't actually apply to science. They apply, excuse me, they apply to economic transactions, or they apply to other kinds of governmental interactions, but they don't actually apply to science. And so in the late 1950s in particular, we see an extended debate about what it would mean to do this. And Wallace Brody, who of course had had this long career in government service, in his role at State Department, very strongly took the side of, no, of course you can't exclude science from the rest of foreign policy. If you don't recognize North Korea, that applies to everything. Science doesn't get a free pass. Whereas other members of the scientific community, particularly Detlef Franck at the National Academies of Science, made a compelling argument that the prestige politics and the cultural politics of the Cold War outweighed that, and that science should, in fact, get a pass. This particular example was worked out with a fairly complicated solution that involved representatives from the National Academies of Science as kind of quasi-representatives playing on other countries' confusion about whether the National Academies was actually an official U.S. body or not. But it's pretty typical of the ways that the United States was attempting to establish some fairly complicated ways of thinking about science and its relationship to the government that would allow American scientists to think of themselves as operating separate from governmental control. So these are all the kinds of things that I was thinking about as I was putting the book together. And then, of course, Trump was elected, and it became very clear that this book was no longer a prehistory of science diplomacy as it was being conducted at the time that I was writing it. The Trump administration, of course, was not particularly interested in science diplomacy. They weren't particularly interested in most kinds of diplomacy, particularly kind of cultural diplomacy. And that, combined with the way that the Trump administration approached other kinds of science advising, really forced a reckoning among American scientists to reflect on what they meant when they said that science has no politics, or that science was separate from politics. And so you see the first blushes of trying to grapple with this in the spring of 2017, so fairly early into the Trump administration, with the March for Science. And the March for Science, when it was first called, I think many Americans assumed that it would be about the harms that would come to American society if science was sidelined. But that's not actually what the organizers had in mind. The organizers had in mind specifically attacks on science as opposed to the consequences of sidelining science. They originally said that it was not a political event, that somehow you were going to have an international protest movement that was not a political event. After they got a lot of pushback on that, the March for Science officially became non-political but nonpartisan. That was the language that they used. And so a lot of what came out of the March for Science really ended up looking like science advocacy as opposed to other kinds of mass mobilization politics. And I've chosen a few photographs here that I found particularly striking from that march. There were a lot of signs that really invoke the language of scientism, which has a certain kind of politics. And there were multiple signs that reflected kind of campaign slogans from the Trump campaigns itself, like "Science made America great the first time." I have lost the photo, but there is one from a Canadian March for Science that said "Science first," using kind of language that I found fairly disturbing. And a week later, there was a different kind of science mobilization. A week after the March for Science, you had the Global Climate March, in which scientists were often marching shoulder to shoulder with indigenous activists, environmental justice activists, people from the labor movement, really enacting a very different kind of politics. So within 2 weeks of the spring of 2017, we saw scientists really thinking about what does it mean to do politics in a different kind of way than they had been before. Fast forward 3 years, now we have COVID. The Trump administration, of course, withdrew from the Paris Climate Accords. We've seen the dismantling of most scientific advisory boards. Depending on how closely you follow American politics and the politics of science in the United States, some of you may have caught an episode about a year ago or 2 years ago where President Trump got into a fight with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration about the path of a hurricane and tried to have someone fired for like forecasting hurricanes. There have been a series of events like this. And collectively, this assault on expertise has really pushed the scientific community much further than it was willing to go in 2017 to think about politics. So this summer, this fall, Scientific American endorsed Joe Biden. The journal Nature also endorsed Joe Biden. The magazine Science is prohibited by its tax status from making endorsements, but they ran an editorial saying science has always been political. And of course, Joe Biden himself began treating scientists as a kind of constituency during the election, tweeting out things like, "Listen to the scientists." So what I've really been trying to think about this past year, what I want to write next, has been how thinking about history can help both historians and scientists have more thoughtful conversations about what kind of roles we want for expertise in this country. Right? Saying listen to the scientists full stop may not be enough, because that's how you get things like eugenics. That's how you get science that say things like science first. But this broader conversation in which more American scientists are understanding that, of course, science has a politics, of course, science does not exist separately from science, I actually find that to be one of the brighter lights of 2020, that it gives opportunities for scientists to make and claim choices about what they're doing in their lives and in their work. And of course, these choices are going to affect our global society for years to come. So I've really been trying to explore this in a newsletter. I'm not really ready to commit to a book-length project at this point. So I have, I've been trying to write out some of my thoughts semi-publicly in a newsletter at the intersection of science and history and politics, trying to explore what it would mean to incorporate the language of politics into science in a way that doesn't imply scientism, but also that doesn't imply technocracy, that really lays out pathways for scientists to participate in broader struggles for equality and justice. And I'm fascinated by the ways that history can contribute to that. So thank you.
Audra, thank you so much for a wonderful and inspiring speech. Really interesting. We will take, you can, if you have questions, please put them into the chat function as we go along, and we'll have Q&A afterwards. So we will move to Margaret Peacock, please.
So thank you so much, Victoria and Piers and everyone at the London School of Economics for having us. We wish that we could have been there. We would have gone out for good curry tonight. It would have been lovely, but you know, it is what it is, as the King in Orange says, and that's what we call Trump in my house. You know, we'll make do. We'll put up our good English, lip and keep going. Okay, so I am actually a Cold War historian and a Russianist who this past January got together with Dr. Eric Peterson, who's a professor in philosophy of science in my department, to keep a journal, basically, of the events that were happening around us, and at the same time offering, you know, a lot of in-depth historical analysis and recounting the contradictions that were unfolding as the presidential election, you know, heated up. When we started the journal in January, we really had no idea, you know, that the year would become what it became. It was initially a, you know, an intellectual exercise. But by March, you know, this simple journal project had become a full-time occupation, including the collection of over 5,000 sources and a growing number of interviews with people from all walks of life across the United States. In May, we shopped the project to our agent and signed a contract with Beacon Press to produce a book and an accompanying digital humanities archive. By the end of 2020, 120,000 word book, which actually is at this point 160,000 words, we're going to have to cut, called The Journal of a Pandemic Year, which for those of us who are historians know that that's a tacit reference to The Journal of the Plague Year by Daniel Defoe, his 17th century book. And it's in many ways sort of an homage to Defoe's project. So since then, we've spent every waking hour not spent managing food shortages and anxious children and teaching courses and writing, you know, all those other stuff that we have to do to manage our lives, basically writing this book. And this is my first time to speak publicly about the project, and I really appreciate the opportunity to share our findings with you guys. So, you know, we've all lived through this year, and we're all aware of the trauma that we have all undergone. Not being able to do the things we once took for granted, like going to the movies, eating in restaurants, even hugging or shaking hands has been really jarring. Some of us have lost work or housing, have been sick or had family that was sick or even passed away, have been arrested because we've participated in protests in June and July and August and September. It's an incomprehensible loss, and we will struggle for decades, I think, to come to terms with it. This book that we are writing, The Journal of a Pandemic Year, is just that. It's a journal written in real time that we've been writing in real time as events were unfolding, with all the rawness and confusion that has characterized this experience. I mean, it also represents a first attempt by historians to actually understand the larger meanings of these pandemics. And we definitely are talking about more than one pandemic, I think, in 2020, for thinking about ourselves and our history. And it is a concerted effort to build a real archive of the, you know, sort of ephemera of the year that will otherwise be lost to the ether for future historians to use. And so today I want to talk about those meanings, or at least I want to give it a shot. You know, we have not finished the book yet. I mean, the year has not ended. And we're just now sitting down to write the introduction and the conclusion, as all good historians do, right? You always write the introduction at the end. That said, I think there are some lessons already emerging that are worth sharing. So in order to get at this question of meaning, I want to suggest that the world of, ready, developmental biology offers an interesting way of thinking about this year's experience. So let me jar you for a moment and talk about developmental biology. And it's interesting to hear Audra dipping into the world of science as, you know, it intersects with politics. And here I am kind of dipping into the world of developmental biology to think in new ways about how it intersects with historiography and with historical methodology in similar ways that Morelli and Hayden White, right, used literary metaphors to, you know, to push historians to think in new ways and new historiographical ways. Here I am sort of saying, let's look at what developmental biology might give us to give us new tools to sort of think about our world and history. So Conrad Waddington, who was a developmental biologist at Cambridge in the 1930s, had this metaphor for how genes control the development of organisms. So stay with me for a minute. He asked his colleagues to imagine a number of marbles rolling down a hill. The marbles roll down the grooves on the slope of the hill, you know, with its hills and its valleys, and they come to rest at the lowest points. These points represent the eventual fate of each cell as it goes from its genetic inception, you know, its beginnings with its genes, to its point of final development. Now, he devised this metaphor as a means to explain the relationship between the genotype, meaning the genetic stock that we all inherit from our parents, and the phenotype, meaning the organism that we finally become. And he did not believe, as many biologists do to these days, certainly since the days of Watson and Crick, that the genotype, that our genotype, that our genetic coding simply codes our phenotype, that the genotype just determines the phenotype. Instead, he offered this metaphor, arguing that our genes create a landscape for what we can become. And as we roll down, as the marbles roll down that landscape, as we roll down the landscape, environmental factors shape what we become at the end. Over time, certain paths on that landscape get worn, they get canalized, as Waddington called it, increasing the odds that we will develop in particular ways over and over again, right? You know, imagine the marble continues to fall down one hill. The hill gets deeper and more grooved, and so the odds are that the marble will keep falling down that hill in that way. But there is always the possibility that the marble will take a different route, taking us down a different developmental pathway. Now, this is a biological metaphor, but it also, I think, works as a political metaphor. It provides a useful way, I think, of understanding why the United States responded like it did to the many crises of 2020. It also, I will argue, provides a possible way of thinking about this year's impact on the path of American history. Okay, so as of today, over 250,000 Americans have died from COVID-19. 8 million workers in the U.S. have lost their jobs. 42,000 people have died from opioid overdoses. George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and countless others have lost their lives just for being Black in America. Our question in this book is, how did our country's historical genes build the epigenetic landscape that Waddington created that shaped our possibilities and options for this year? Now, when 2020 hit, we were in a space where certain outcomes were far more likely to happen because that developmental path had been trodden historically over and over again by all the people that came before us. The genes that shaped our country were there from the beginning, were there from our inception. Slavery, the rise of the incarceral state for the management of the Black and brown body, the decentralized system that prioritizes states' rights over federal leadership, the privatization of healthcare, the widespread commitment to unquestioning nationalism and the adherence to capitalism and the gospel of wealth. All of these are the genes that were present at our inception and were there when 2020 started. And then 2020 hit us, and all these factors contributed to a whole series of pandemics that swept across the country, from COVID to race riots to an out-of-control opioid crisis to mass unemployment and homelessness. We were forced to look more closely at the genes that have sat at the root of this country's inception. And this forced awareness is, by the way, I should add, something that happens frequently when pandemics arise. The historian of science, Charles Rosenberg, has argued that pandemics expose the fault lines and the weaknesses of a society. In no time has this been truer than in the United States in 2020. These pandemics have exposed the cycles of negligence and death, perpetration and vengeance that sit at the core of the founding of this country. As many scholars and journalists have noted, decades of neglect and avarice have created a broken healthcare system, a society racked by racist structures that impact every facet of life, a system that offers little support to the unemployed and destitute, a culture that prioritizes personal gain over the public good, and a desire for entertainment over difficult dialogue and learning. Now, in many ways, what we have seen this year is the extent to which our nation's response to these crises was heavily prescribed by history, was absolutely stamped from the beginning, as Ibram Kendi puts it, by the deep grooves in our genetic makeup to continue as they had before. So, for instance, take our longstanding predilection to prioritize the media spectacle over substantive dialogue and learning in the United States. We are a nation that has always deified its celebrities over its thinkers, that has been motivated by nationalistic, patriotic calls to arms over thoughtful attention to nuance, that has gravitated to showmen like Joseph McCarthy and Andrew Jackson. Now, in the 21st century, now, where we are now, we've become a nation tied to the myopic vapidity of the Twitterverse. We have, in so many ways, experienced the culmination of two centuries of infotainment functioning as a mechanism of power in our culture. So much of this year has been controlled and shaped by how information is conveyed to us through media. Americans didn't care about black bodies until they saw a man choked to death on YouTube. We didn't care about mask wearing until we saw bodies being buried in mass graves in New Jersey on Twitter. A critical part of this power lies also in the silences and what we don't talk about and what media doesn't talk about. We don't care about the petroleum industry's shift from oil and gas production for energy into plastic production, which ultimately will have a catastrophic impact on the biosphere. Why? Well, because the media doesn't care about it. The media has always had a massive impact on what we see and don't see, and in so doing, it shapes how we understand the crises of this year. And as we know, in America today, media has become intrinsically partisan, which has in turn played a critical role in making the pandemic a political issue instead of an epidemiological one. And this was exhibited nowhere better. I'm going to give you guys an example, because when you give a good talk, you should always go down into the weeds for a minute. This was exhibited nowhere better than on February the 24th of this past year of 2020, when Rush Limbaugh, who I hope you all in England, you're blessed if you don't know who he is, when Rush Limbaugh declared to his 35 million listeners that the coronavirus was just the common cold, that it has a 98% survival rate, that it was a Chinese communist laboratory experiment, and that in his words, "I think that this is an effort to bring down Trump, and one of the ways to do this is to scare investors." Now, this performance of Limbaugh's presented a series of fragmented realities that came together to create a whole world where even the deceiver was deceived. It created a sense of group unity among his listeners that was founded on delusion, and it demanded that they ignore its contradictions. An estimated 35 million listeners heard Limbaugh spin the yarn that this virus was a political ploy engineered by communists and the liberal press to tear down their president. Limbaugh did not just politicize the virus in February, he transformed it into a space where his audience would be expected to perform in a certain way in order to assert their identity as his followers. Rush babies, they call themselves sometimes. He made dismissing the coronavirus part of the larger performance of being in the know, owning the libs and melting the snowflakes, as they call it. And this spectacle that he created invalidated the realities of this virus, making itself into the real. In our hierarchical society, where genes are coded to, where our genes, our country's genes are coded to lionize the bully, in an endless monologue of self-affirming praise and assumed authority, this performance wielded tremendous power. And it worked because its audience was already primed to believe the spectacle and not to see its contradictions. You know, the spectacle is the bad dream of a modern society in chains, right? That's how Guy Debord put it. And Limbaugh's audience repeated the spectacle over the since he did it, since February, his mass of listeners and the people who also repeated Limbaugh's mantra, right? Trump the next day got up and gave a speech that literally reiterated exactly what Trump had said on the radio the night before. Limbaugh's audience, which replicated over time, then set off repeating that spectacle. They replicated it on social media, at the grocery store, and at the ballot box. This is an argument I've made in previous scholarship, right? That those who own the means of image production are also the ones who control the production of meaning. Now, another example of how our nation's development is heavily prescribed by our past, by our genes, can be seen in the failed efforts we have made over our nation's lifetime to rein in police violence against Black and Brown people. Another pandemic, right? The pandemic of systemic racism in America. In 1947, Harry Truman commissioned a 175-page report from the government-sponsored Committee on Civil Rights. It offered a harrowing examination of police violence against African Americans. Some defenders of the law have become lawless, it concluded. Race prejudice governed many interactions between the police and African Americans. Black men, even ones who were unarmed or running away, were killed disproportionately because white cops believed they were acting in their own self-defense. Police departments thoroughly covered up minority deaths, especially when it was obvious a cop was to blame. This thorough government investigation, which happened in 1947, revealed that at best, those extrajudicial killings by cops demonstrated incompetence, and at worst, they reflected a callous willingness to kill. Such a deep bigotry that Black lives could not possibly matter to an officer who was authorized and equipped to use lethal force and would likely never face jail time or even arrest, as they well knew. And again, in 1968, the LBJ-era Kerner Commission concluded that the police have come to symbolize white power, white racism, and white repression. 52 years later in 2020, in the summer of 2020, we all watched the torture and death of George Floyd, and we read about the murder of Breonna Taylor and many others. This feels written. This feels like it's coded in our genes. It feels prescribed. Many scholars have argued that the soil of this country was salted and stamped from the beginning. Now, one of the obvious takeaways from this book is that we are not the nation we thought we were, that our history has created a landscape of possible paths that absolutely do include unchecked epidemic, rampant nationalism and racism, wartime profiteering, and widespread disregard for the needs of other Americans. As Daniel Defoe put it in 1655 in his Journal of a Plague Year, when he chronicled the experience of the plague that was raging through London, "I cannot but take notice that the strange temper of the people contributed extremely to their own destruction." So here's the question. What do we do about it? What does it take to actually make change happen? What does it take to make the marble go down the epigenetic landscape in a different way? Or are we just doomed? Now, I've interviewed numerous people who went out into the streets every night after George Floyd's death. I myself was out every night for 3 months, and they believed, as I did at the protests, that we were there to make change happen, even though the epigenetic landscape seems to say that we are not likely to affect much change. And I'm not sure I know the answer. C.H. Waddington argued that in order for a developmental change to happen, there has to be a severe, strident, and lengthy environmental push to alter development. And so the question is, was 2020 enough of a severe, strident, and lengthy environmental push to be a transformative moment to actually change the marble? The Path of the Marble. Now, so far this fall, we have started to see some change. But it's incremental. It's not revolutionary. And that's something we have to start to wrap ourselves, our brains around. In Portland, for instance, they've removed the white armed police officers from the predominantly African-American schools. In an interview with that I did with Tim Keller, the mayor of Albuquerque, he described how in New Mexico, he described how they are redirecting emergency calls, 911 calls, that are associated with mental illness and homelessness to social workers instead of to the police. Because substance abuse clinics had to close in March, methadone access has increased for people suffering from substance abuse disorders. Because child abuse centers have had to close, medical training for recognizing and reporting on abuse has been systematized far more carefully among medical practitioners in the United States than it ever was before. Because of the steady reporting and awareness of police violence against BIPOC populations, and cities across America are starting to find alternative ways to address implicit bias in public safety. Because we're in the middle of a pandemic that has killed over 250,000 people, every American has been forced to think about public health and their individual role in shaping this crisis, even if they consciously choose to disregard it. Maybe the changes that we would like to see are never going to come in revolutionary leaps. Maybe it isn't that, maybe we don't need the marble to jump over into a new canal. Maybe it's going to be a slow Darwinian or Spencerian or a Hofstadter kind of erosion into a new canal that's going to have to happen. Or maybe, as James Baldwin argues, it is just theater. All of these little incremental changes are just theater. They're just pretense. And there is no sustained, you know, forceful push that can make this kind of desired evolutionary change happen. If there were going to be any transformative upheaval that would change us, surely it would be a mass pandemic followed by the public viewing of a black man being tortured and executed on the street by a white police officer. We are at World War II death levels here in the United States, and yet no revolutionary change seems to be on the horizon. We need to understand this year, I think, in order to make a change. And that is a critical payoff for this book. If we want to be different, we're going to have to jerk the wheel on the boat, to mix my metaphors. We have to decide, despite our seeming helplessness, that we are not historically determined, that we aren't just stuck in the rut of this marble going down the landscape the same way every year, or every, you know, in every interaction, in every moment that we live our lives. And that there is still possibility, you know, to carve a new future. History has created the world in which we must reluctantly reside, but I hope that it has not fated us and that we are not stamped. The choices that have been made by every human being this year, I would argue, have mattered. In fact, perhaps it is in the moment of human agency, in people's ability to choose differently, that we will find a way to carve a new path. Over the course of this brutal year, Journal of a Pandemic Year, this book makes the argument that we can choose to be compassionate. We can choose to try and understand the perspectives of others as we search for dialogue, and that we must face our history honestly. Now, a few more thoughts. Because Journal of a Pandemic Year is written as a daily journal, it consciously confronts the historical conceits of hindsight. You know, historians, you know, when we write history books, we write history books as though, you know, A happened, then B, then C, then D, as though there's this implied, written, determined narrative that went very clearly, where there's a lovely sort of story that progresses without too much backward having to look, right? Being too much confusion, without too much sort of uncertainty. And historians will, for decades to come, endeavor to tell a comprehensive story of the nightmare that was this year. Not only will they overlook the places where other possibilities arose, but they will also forget the profound chaos of this experience. Journal of a Pandemic Year seeks to remind future readers that national catastrophes are characterized first and foremost by profound uncertainty. There is a real value in standing witness to the difficulty of knowing what to do in the moment that an emergency is happening. To the daily toll of death, guilt, and anger, to the small choices that force you to re-examine where your boundaries lie and who you think you are, and, you know, to the sheer fatigue of it all. A critical component of this book also rests on the conviction that readers need to have access to every source that has been used in writing this book. And that is because we live in a post-truth universe now, where, you know, people choose to believe truth simply because they believe them, not because they are actually founded in evidence. And so we are very much committed to having the book be in the book. You can read the book, and in any given entry, you can go to the accompanying digital humanities site. You can punch in the date of the entry that you're reading, and you can pull up all of the sources that were used to write that entry. Eventually, it will become a massive resource filled with stuff that we didn't use to write the entry, but you can check my sources. You can go ahead and check my sources. In fact, what I want you to do is read the entry and then go dive like a Where's Waldo book into those sources and get lost down the rabbit hole of each day and how profoundly overwhelming every single one of these days were. This is going to be done through the construction of this accompanying digital humanities archive. So readers will be able to search, and the archive will serve these two very vital functions. First, it'll allow readers to look for themselves, to remember their own stories and experiences, and to discover the things they didn't realize were happening around them at the time. And second, it's going to provide an ever-expanding source collection for future researchers. So accompanying the book already are a database with over 5,000 sources, the footnotes on this book are going to be out of control because there are no IBIDs. Everything shows up once. We haven't even figured out how we're going to pull that off. It also has a corresponding file system holding screenshots of sources that are no longer accessible on the internet. We all think that in the world of the internet, sources are constantly available. But if I would challenge you to go back and see if you can find a friend on Twitter and go back and find what they wrote back in January. All of it gets wiped. All of it is gone. Those sources, the sources that show up in the ephemera of the internet, are far more transient than any source base we have ever had in our history. So there's also a growing collection of interactive maps and data sets and a database of stories and interviews from people all over the country. So hopefully, you know, I've given you guys a sense for what we're working on. And I'm really excited to have a conversation with folks and to hear what you think about this idea for the epigenetic landscape as a metaphor for thinking about history and this year. And thank you very much.
Margaret, thank you so much for a wonderful and engaging talk. I'm sure there'll be lots of questions. And we will move now to Patrick.
Okay, I think I unmuted myself successfully. All right, so first of all, thanks, Victoria, for inviting me, for organizing this. I'm sure it must have been quite a headache to be trying to change all the plans in real time. I really appreciate being here with my esteemed co-panelists. Thanks, Pierce, for the introduction, and thanks to the LSE for hosting. I hope everyone's doing well. So I'll use my 20 minutes to introduce my subject, who is the photographer Lisa Larsen, and also to signal some vague themes that I'm developing in relation to her biography and her work. And I chose to discuss Lisa Larsen in particular today because her story as a cultural mediator, I think, lends itself quite well to this reflection about the Cold War in a number of ways. And I have to say, I also admire her photography very much. So her work has been quite therapeutic in recent months, shall we say, as an aesthetic experience, but also as a historical experience that carries an appealing resonance today, I think, because the 1950s were a decade that coincided with the period of Larsen's most prolific and mature work. But it also marked a shift from a period of uncertainty about the world to a period of hope, in a way, not just in the West, but in the second world of socialism and in the third world. However elusive that hope may have been, I think it was a different kind of, it was a change. So That being said, this is very much a work in progress, and I'm saying this as a cultural historian of Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union, who followed Larsen to the United States, so to speak, and who's trying to unpack for the first time really these layered issues related to gender history, women's history, and the history of the United States. So it's a little bit intimidating, but that's also why I'm also very thrilled to share my work here with colleagues like the co-panelists who have written about these issues more extensively. So on that note, let me try to share my screen. And let's see. To the presentation. Oh, that's my last slide, sorry. I don't know how that happened. Okay, so this is it. This is my intro page. And so I think Lisa Larsen is relatively unknown as a person, particularly among historians. But I think that her life and her work bring together several themes that are quite important to the 1950s and to the international history, because she was a photographer, but she was also a thinker and a writer, and she was connected to different parts of the world. She came to the United States as a child in 1939 in November from Germany. Her family was fleeing Nazi Germany, and she began making this brilliant career in the United States, working for Life magazine starting in 1949. And she traveled to Asia as a photojournalist for Life, to Asia, South America, Eastern Europe, Soviet Union. She was also a woman in the world of men, which also mattered. And so her story is fascinating, I think, because it coincides with a fascinating phase of the Cold War, but it also reveals these layers of international cultural entanglements that do not easily fit into the Cold War divisions. And I think it also points to a very interesting relationship between politics of photography that I'm also trying to explore. I should mention that Larsen's story is a really relatively short one, because she died early. She died of cancer in 1959, and she was 37. But her story is, in her life was rather intense. It was filled with reflection about social issues and international politics. And it was full of personal experiences with people all over the world, many of whom were powerful people, people with whom Larsen was able to strike up this natural emotional rapport, and which then led her to take these close-up photos of them. Larsen's name jumped out at me first from the classified reports of the Polish security police that I was working with for a project on a Poznan International Trade Fair in Poland. Larsen came to Poland in 1957 to get a feel of the country that had been shaken up by all these changes just the year before. One of which was the uprising in Poznan on June 28th of 1956. And Larsen was there in 1957, she also did this photo shoot for Life of the Poznan Fair, focusing naturally on the U.S. pavilion, which was this. This was the Buckminster Fuller Geodesic Dome. And this was also a time when the U.S. premiered in Behind the Iron Curtain for the first time. So this is another set of photos from the same occasion. People inside the dome lining up for frozen food exhibit on the right, and on the left you can see people trying to peek into the single family home, which was a big attraction there. By the time Larsen arrived in Poland, she was known as a photojournalist. For Life magazine, she covered these different aspects of American cultural life and social life and politics that included the wedding of JFK and Jackie Bouvier in 53. And she also followed Grace Kelly's limousine in 1956 to a department store in New York, causing some mild breaches of protocol because Kelly had just become Princess of Monaco. But it all ended well, as you can see on the photograph. She covered numerous other events and kinds of events, shooting naturalization ceremonies, this one in New York, sports events, presidential campaigns, and grassroots election activism. When in the United States, she came close to powerful people, taking this picture of Eleanor Roosevelt and Vijaya Lakshmi Pandit. She covered visits of foreign leaders. Here on the picture is Princess Elizabeth, 1951. I'm not sure if this is actually in the United States. And she also took that photo of Prime Minister of Iran, Mohammad Mossadegh, on his hospital bed in New York, so in a rather vulnerable position. In 1951, she took that picture of Vice President Alban Barkley in bathrobe and PJs on the congressional campaign trail. And on the right, you can see also an interesting photograph of the Secretary of Defense, Assistant Secretary of Defense, Anna Rosenberg, in 1952, which illustrates her interest in the role of women on different levels of society in all the societies that she actually explored with her camera. In 1954, Larsen traveled to South America to photograph social conditions there. And this particular photo was selected for the famous or infamous exhibition called The Family of Men that premiered at the MoMA in 55 and then toured the whole world. And 1955, Larsen went to Bandung, Indonesia to cover the Afro-Asian conference, photographing the numerous attending leaders, but also photographing the crowds that were so excited to see the dignitaries arrive. The crowds were, of course, part of the event's choreography there. In 1955, also, she traveled by herself throughout East and Southeast Asia. Here are two pictures from Laos and Cambodia. And in 1956, she went to the Soviet Union for several months. The picture on the left is from Leningrad, and the picture on the right is from Outer Mongolia, where she'd been invited by one of the officials during her trip to the Soviet Union. She was the first woman to photograph, first Westerner really to photograph that that region in a decade. As I mentioned, 1957, she spent several months in Poland, taking this picture of Władysław Gomułka on the picture on the photograph on the left with Ho Chi Minh. And Ho Chi Minh, I like this photo very much, accepting a bouquet of flowers from his admirer that you cannot really see, but you see Ho Chi Minh. And the flowers, of course. So there's an interesting punchline there. And in 1958, she went to cover Khrushchev's visit to Hungary, which was her last assignment, really, a major assignment, at least. She also won several major awards in the United States. So she was this up-and-coming press photographer when she passed away in 1959. And the people who studied Larsen, and there are several of them, mostly focused on her photography and mostly work in the visual studies and art history fields. And they've pointed to Larsen's interest in crowds in particular, which I think was evident in this sample, and also the intimate nature of these photos. And some have also noted Larsen's attention to the problems of individual agency, and particularly the role of women. Something I've mentioned as well. What I'm fascinated by as I'm starting this project is the way in which Larsen's thinking about the United States is intertwined with thinking about Eastern Europe and the other way around. And particularly, I'm interested in how her thinking about Poland contravened America's Cold War cosmology. which in Molly Nolan's words often boils down to this simple model of cultural competition in which, quote, America came, Western Europe succumbed, and Eastern Europe envied. And I think that Larson, through her photography and through her writing, challenges this kind of thinking in a couple of ways. On the one hand, she makes that model ambiguous through her photography, which focuses on the similarities rather than differences in the emotional responses of individuals and crowds. And in some cases, in particular in her unpublished book manuscript, which I was, I've been also working with, Larson also goes further and draws on her perceptions of social relations in Poland to think more critically about social relations in the United States. To show what I mean, let me go back to this standard Cold War narrative for a moment and use it as a starting point, which I think is useful, particularly because the American press used Larson's photography extensively to drive home this standard Cold War narrative about American superiority and East European backwardness was also a big part of it. So this is a stark example from July 1957, issue of Life, an article titled The U.S. Exhibit of Freedom Hit in Poland, which is devoted, of course, to the U.S. exhibit at the 57 trade fair in Poznań, and which shows crowds of Polish visitors in the U.S. pavilion being entertained, being mesmerized by America and yearning for a better life. In the spirit of the times, the article also draws these linkages between the absence of political freedom and absence of consumer goods. So in fact, the reception of this US show in Poznań was far more critical, but I think what's even more important is that this contrast between American modernity and East European backwardness is likely not fully what Lisa Larson had in mind when she took those photos for that issue of Life magazine. To understand what she was after, let's accompany Larson to Warsaw in 1957. Larson was a wanderer. She was a flaneuse. She liked to follow the crowds. You can see the quotation from her book on the screen. And one day in 1957, while wandering in the city center of Warsaw with her interpreter, who was also working for the security police, she followed the crowd into a department store. And then she went up to the fifth floor and discovered what she called a huge screaming mob guarded by police, hundreds of hands stretched out for a precious numbered ticket as if they were starving for the last loaf of bread. But she realized that the riot had nothing to do with starvation. Instead, customers were fighting over mouton furs that had shipped that morning, and it was, of course, a rare consumer item in a socialist state. And so Larson climbed up on a stool to photograph the rioting, but then the crowd saw her and an angry man started to attack her. And so she had to hide under the counter, wait out the riot. And then she quietly left when the chaos subsided with the help of her interpreter. And this is one of the photos she took of the what she called a fur riot. And this is how the U.S. Media in this particular case, The Sign, a Catholic magazine, showed it using the caption, like the women seeking goods that cannot fill the demand, Poland lives on freedom and short supply. Again, linking the scarcity of goods, the scarcity of freedom, which was a typical thing to do. Now, Larson knew that the Polish economy was in a bad shape, and she saw it everywhere, not only in mouton furs, but toilet paper was also in short supply, so people hoarded it whenever it actually appeared. But what she was fascinated by, again, was this more universal response of the crowds, a focus that I think blurs the mapping of the world defined around the Cold War. Photography is inherently ambiguous, but Larson makes her interest in diffusing these Cold War contrasts and binaries clear and explicit in some ways, particularly in her draft book, where she draws parallels between her experience in Warsaw and her experience in the United States by recounting the atmosphere at the McCarthy rally in 1954 at the Madison Square Garden, at which, and I'm quoting here, two New Jersey delegates got so angered that their picture was being taken that they started a riot and had me forcefully evicted from the garden. So what seems to have happened is that the group of journalists and photographers, which included Bert Kepler, another photographer, and his wife, whom you can see here in the middle, went there out of curiosity. I'm not sure if Larson was with them, but she certainly took a picture of them. This is the photo. And in any case, the mood at the rally was very solemn, as you can see here. And these journalists were light and laughing, ostensibly not sharing the mood with the McCarthy crowd. And one of the participants got offended by this irreverence and actually hit one of the journalists. And soon Larson also became a target. She became somebody started to yell insults at her. And that's when she and others were wise enough to leave very, very quickly. And then she continued in her draft book to reflect on this experience, writing that the most difficult subject for me to photograph are angry people. People in a state of aroused emotional tension seem to resent the presence of a photographer, partially because his presence tends to make them more acutely aware of their anger. Frequently, this anger is transferred from the actual object to the nearest tangible subject, the photographer. She noted, adding emphatically that the forces which had aroused the McCarthyites in the Madison Square Garden were the same forces that moved the Warsaw Fur rioters into action against this photographer. So that's one example when these Cold War contrasts break down again in an interesting way. But thinking about these emotional psychological forces also led Larson to draw more comparisons between the Warsaw department store and Orbach's, the American department store, specializing in inexpensive clothes. And Larson did a photo shoot at Orbach's in 1952. You can see also sample photos on this next screen. And in response to her adventure in Warsaw department store, she wrote this: on the first floor, a lady's underwear counter reminded me of Orbach's bargain basement, where women stood several lines deep, pressing, pushing, and screaming when someone took too much time to select the right shape or color. And here's another selection. I think what stands out here again is Larson's fascination with crowds. Crowds that are also very intimately portrayed, as some other scholar has observed. They're more like collective portraits of people, but they're crowds nonetheless. So there's this fascination with something that's both more intimate and more universal than the Cold War, I think, and a fascination that she articulates through words and images which defied the dominant Cold War imagery and challenged America's fascination with its own kind of modernity. So the force of this challenge comes from equivocations and visual ambiguities, but in some places in her book, she's also using her experience in Poland to criticize more directly social relations in the United States. She was especially enamored of gender relations in Poland, which she saw as different, certainly more quaint in some ways, but also more dignified. She grew fond, for instance, of getting her hand kissed by Polish men, to a great amusement of her professional companions from the US. But her own position was this. She wrote, somehow, this little gesture made me feel as a woman who was accepted as a woman, even though she was battling in a man's business world, what hilarious and revolutionary changes this custom would bring about if I were introduced in the US business world. If editors, for instance, would bend down to kiss my hand before send me out to cover a fire, if masculine charm were to replace the treat them rough and alike routine of the football coach, in which US males pitifully acknowledge their own sense of insecurity, which they when they retreat to their exclusive male paddock, of the superior vocal cords, the swear words, and table pounding. So that's rather rough. But in her experience, men in Poland acknowledged her as a woman and also as a professional. For instance, when she negotiated some publishing distribution deals in 1957, she was on several occasions, and I corroborated this, able to prevail upon her male negotiators to actually have things done her way. In contrast, she was often critical, not just of gender, but generally social relations in the United States. For instance, at some point she went to the U.S. Congress in her capacity as a photojournalist, but she forgot her license and she couldn't show her credentials to someone who knew her, actually. And so she was trying to explain her position to the guard, but he wouldn't listen. And actually, against her protest, he carried her out physically on his back while she was taking pictures still. So she felt rather bitter about that. And then she came to Poland amidst all these revolutionary upheavals of mid-1950s, where atmosphere was quite different. And she was free to walk about and take photos of Władysław Gomułka and all the other politicians up close, and that really made an impression on her. Of course, everything was more complicated in many ways, because in Poland, she wasn't just a woman, but she was an American, and she was an American journalist at that. So there were many other reasons why she probably felt a certain respect over there. That said, she probably also felt something genuine, at least in the milieu of professionals and politicians that may have included a mix of traditional respect and even reverence for women that derive from traditional patriarchic values, but also included official validation of women as professionals and citizens that to some extent accompanied the arrival of socialist modernity. So in any case, bracketing out the objective truth value of these impressions, there's probably more to think about in that respect. But I think it still matters that she saw these differences between a communist country, in this case Poland, and the United States as meaningful, and that she thought about the U.S. somewhat critically through Poland, through her Polish experience. And by the way, to the extent that I know, she was not a communist. She was not a fellow traveler. So I think that her work in Poland does help understand her photography in the U.S. and also puts into perspective how Larsen's cultural output, when taken on its own terms, contravened this prevailing American discourse about the Cold War. Thank you.
Patrick, thank you so much. These are all just amazing presentations and so inspiring. Blanche, we'd love to hear from you.
I'm going to unmute. Really, I'm so moved to be here. And I'm so excited by the work of everybody on this panel. And Victoria, you've done just a great job. I'm just so honored to be among you. I was going to focus on Esther Laip and her campaign for a national healthcare plan, because of this moment, we need Medicare for all. We need single payer. We need what Britain had in the 1947, a National Health Service Plan. It's what we need. And it was what we were supposed to have as early as 1935. It was actually supposed to be in the Social Security Act of 1935. And I was very interested, and have been all along, that the AMA lobbied it to death. And the AMA was really, I wonder if I could go on, poke on to me. So, because I want to say, I'm looking at you, Victoria. Here.
We can see you, Blanche.
You can. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So, but everybody's work is so important to all the work that I've done over the years, especially Lisa Lawson was very important. This is for later. She was very important in the Eisenhower administration, and you know, the propaganda, the whole question of the Cold War. And here we are in 2020, where everything is coming together, as Margaret so clearly points out. It's, we're one world. And, you know, we go from, in my studies, I'm very engaged, as Eleanor Roosevelt was. And I think why I spent so much time on her and why she's so worth it is that she never stopped growing and changing. And in the end, she agreed completely with Wendell Willkie, who ran against FDR in 1940, and they really had a great friendship. So in 1944, they were going to start a new party and run together, which is really, really interesting. A party that acknowledged we are one world, no borders, no boundaries, no walls. And Wendell Willkie's famous speech, One World, everything that happens anywhere impacts on everybody everywhere. And here we are in this year of the pandemic when it's so clear that we are one world and absolutely the same in so many ways, and yet so different in so many ways. And the U.S. following its hideous history, which has gotten buried. The good news about its hideous history, in my opinion, is that there are always people who protested. And there are people who are marching in a new way. And as I have been saying to all my friends, we must march again, my darlings. So there is hope. And I think Medicare for all is the great hope. I do want to read the AMA's protest to even having Social Security. This is 1935. The AMA had a special session of its House of Delegates, the first since World War I, and passed a resolution condemning compulsory health insurance and its opposition to the entire Social Security program. The health insurance proposals worked out are buried in an unpublished report. Even the phrase health insurance was stricken out of the Social Security bill. And this is when Esther Lape creates, in 1937, a wonderful new committee, which results in a book, American Medicine Expert Testimony Out of Court, because the AMA was really the chief union of the physicians, but there were lots and lots, thousands of physicians who said, we really need healthcare for all. How are we going to imagine a future with such a sick society as the U.S. Was at the time? There was no healthcare access for poor people. It's really an incredible story. And you go right through to what we have, Medicare, Medicaid. Eisenhower, 1958, had the great sense. He wanted health care for everybody just the way it was in the military, the servicemen covered and their families covered, everybody. And that resulted in a 1958 health care program, which is essentially the beginning of Medicare and Medicaid. And he invited, this is the Republican Dwight David Eisenhower, invited Eleanor Roosevelt and Esther Lape to help him promote what he had in mind. And they lobbied for Esther Lape's vision, which was health care for all, single payer. When he gave the pen that he signed, that 1958 bill, he gave the pen to Esther Lape, and she waved it to the press, and she said, now this represents just a puny little bone in the vertebrae of what I had in mind. And there is no biography of Esther Lape, L-A-P-E, and over the years, I've been saying that to every public event that I speak at. It's really amazing to me because she really is one of the great shining light visionaries. She has a lot to do with Eleanor Roosevelt's, you know, development as a political thinker, as a person, and her partner, Elizabeth Reed, wrote a textbook, a law text. She was an international lawyer, and her international law textbook was used all over the country at Yale and at Harvard. They were very famous in their worlds, and yet nobody has written about them, which is great mystery to me. But this history of healthcare for all is really an astonishing thing. And it gets involved and mired down by insurance. And you have the insurance companies and really the insurance ripoff, which a lot of physicians oppose. So you have this insurance versus healthcare for all. And I just want to go slowly here for a second. In the 1930s, healthcare was opposed as socialist. And then in 1947, Truman introduced a healthcare for all bill, which was lobbied to death in 1947, again by the AMA, which didn't call it socialist, they called it Hitlerian. It was fascist. You don't want Nazis in charge of your healthcare because, you know, now the Soviet Union was momentarily an ally. But then in the 50s, again, healthcare for all was attacked as socialist. And I think the difference now and the great hope, and for Margaret, this is, you know, where are we going? Are we stuck in the mire? Are we moving? I think the word socialist is no longer hideous to everybody, not just to Bernie, but to young people. So the idea of finally having health care for all, Medicare for everybody, and giving up on, you know, this insurance reality is a great hope for the future. So there we are. We're still in the middle of it. And I'll take any questions. Esther Lape, let me just say that she did three volumes, Health Security for the Nation. There's a wonderful article, Health in Handcuffs. And then Esther Lape did a two-volume study, American Medicine in Mid-Century, which is really very interesting, where her physicians, and there are 1,000 of them, and one of the leaders of her group is Hugh Cabot, who is very important to the history of medicine. So they're really eminent physicians who oppose the AMA opposition. And I'm happy to note that the AMA now has finally begun to move and to say maybe what we need is healthcare for all. This is very recent in this pandemic when insurance was cut because insurance was based on, you know, union contracts where there was health insurance and everybody fired lost their health insurance. So there's no, it's gone, which is why there's, you know, with what is it? You gave the number, how many people unemployed that had been well employed, 80 million, did you say? So they've all lost their health insurance. What we need is health care for all, single payer. Thank you.
Blanche, thank you so much. And I want to thank you all again. What wonderful and inspiring talks. I'm sure we're going to have many questions. But I want to take a moment again also to thank Alice Bryant, who brought us all together, literally, in all of our little boxes. Nothing crashed, PowerPoints worked, People RSVP'd and we're all here. So thank you so much, and to the technical support given by the London School of Economics in managing all of this and publicizing it. And again, a thank you to the International History Department and Matthew and Piers.